Hello, I'm Douglas Frank, and I'm here with Mitra Lee Worley, and we are going to have a conversation about space awareness practice. So thank you, Lee, for joining me.
Okay, thank you.
So how did you start with space awareness practice? How did you connect with this?
Well, I connected with it because I was a person of the theater who had, within the last, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, no, 2 years, left New York theater and moved west to New Mexico and left the company that I had been a part of, and was invited to come up to Boulder to a theater conference. And at the time I was floundering for an identity because I didn't know anybody in Santa Fe, and I had a new baby that took a lot of attention, and I was lost in terms of theater. So theater conference sounded great. And it was put on by this Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who I had briefly met a couple of times in New York, not really talked to, but met. So that was interesting to me. And I was had been a part of the theater company, that one of the members of which had gotten the grants for this theater conference. So I was invited, I think, probably because I was close by and they didn't have to pay for my transportation to Boulder, really. And I was looking forward to seeing some of my old buddies from my theater company in New York, and other companies were supposedly coming. And there was this Mudra Theater that was the theater company of Chogyam Trungpa, and that was kind of exciting. A little curious about what Buddhist theater might be like. So all things going on like that, I went up to Boulder with three of the young guys who were in my new theater company, which was very new, and these were not particularly actors. My husband's friend, who was a restaurant owner, had felt sorry for me because I was sort of without any sense of who am I, and had encouraged me to start a theater group in Santa Fe, and he'd done the publicity for it, and the publicity were posters he put up all over town that said "Get High with Theater." So I had gotten quite a good number of Santa Fe young people to come along. And three of them were interested in coming up to Boulder with me. And we all came up to this, quote, theater conference, which turned out to be kind of a chaotic jumble of theater, avant-garde theater companies from the U.S., although other people had been invited, and this group of baby Buddhists, of students of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who were the Mudra Theater Group. And that was not an introduction to what the space awareness work was, but it was an introduction to his, Trungpa's, view of how theater could be a useful vehicle for beginning to help the Western world have an understanding of Buddhist thought and Buddhist psychology.
And what year would that have been?
The conference was February of 1973.
Okay. And what was his sense of how theater could be a practice or a vehicle, would you say?
Well, at that first conference, he gave a series of talks about this, thinking about how it's not like it would be a radically different external, you could do a Broadway musical or anything else, but that the training of the performers would be more of an authenticness to it than what we usually see in the kind of show business world. And some kind of encouragement to the playwrights that he wasn't suggesting that they shouldn't be having political views and so on, but that it's wise, shall we say, to allow some space for the audience to join in the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And that sort of the authentic presence of the performers is what is the magnetism of making the event, not the storyline or the smoke and mirrors stuff of it. And all of these things that he was talking about were things that I felt, I thought. I had left New York because I had these thoughts, although they weren't nearly as beautifully shaped at that time. So it was kind of like he was answering the questions that I didn't quite know I had, but there they were, you know, because I had always thought of theater and performing and so on as being a kind of a spiritual exercise and a artistic process being a spiritual process. Vaguely, not necessarily a religious one, but, you know, some kind of transcending the mundane world, let's say.
So did he talk about how, in terms of theater, how an actor or performer would tap into this authentic presence?
He didn't, not during that conference. Okay. He talked about the Maitri Buddha family energies. He talked about the work that he and his group had been doing with exercises and a little bit about some of the plays that they had worked on and the play called Kingdom of Philosophy, which he had written and so on. But he was more inviting the visiting theater companies to talk about their techniques and their insights. And because, as he said quite sweetly during the conference, you know, we're a brand new company here, and we're hoping that we could learn something from your skills and your techniques, and maybe you might learn something from ours, and we could have a dialogue about East-West theater.
So there was a curiosity on his part about what the other theater companies could offer.
I think very much so, very genuinely. So also in terms of his company, I think he was a spokesperson for these baby Buddhist theater people, many of whom had some sketchy or not so sketchy relationship to performance, but none of whom was really, you know, coming from a career that had a name behind it or anything. And all of them were very new, because everybody was very new at meditation.
Right.
Or the meditative mind, or mind altogether.
Right.
But the exercises themselves that are the space awareness work were not introduced at that conference particularly.
So when were they introduced?
After the conference, all the artists went home, and he stayed working with his little company. And then during about a week after that conference, he presented not all of the exercises that we learned eventually, but the kind of core exercises, you could maybe say the shamatha of the practice, was introduced to the mudra students at that time.
Okay. And when were you introduced to these
exercises?
Yes.
Well, I went away from that conference vowing that I had something to learn from all of this and wanting to get back. And magically enough, the next summer, the summer of 1974, the Naropa Institute began. And I didn't know anything about it, but one of the members of the company that I had been part of in New York, who had been at the theater conference, was invited to be a theater teacher at the Naropa Institute. And he could only do one of the two sessions. And he asked if I would be willing to teach for him during the other session, which happened to be the first session. And I said, yes.
Right. Oh, that's great.
No question about that. So I got to go to the Naropa Institute and teach my little theater class and study meditation and get a peek in here and there at what the Mudra Theater Group was doing,
mm-hmm.
which was working with exercises and working on a performance called Prajna, which is based in the Heart Sutra.
Now, did you participate in any of those workshops with the Mudra Theater Group?
Not that summer.
Okay.
No. But when I finally moved up to Boulder, then I definitely joined the workshops and took courses at Naropa. Yeah, started practicing.
And at that point, was Trungpa Rinpoche the main teacher for the space awareness practices?
Well, of course, he would always be the main teacher, but mm-hmm. he wasn't always the one who was leading the exercises. He was the one that was teaching the exercises, and then the students were learning how to lead them, because essentially the practice consists of a series of relatively simple and repetitive exercises that are guided by someone who's keeping track of the timing of the exercise and, you know, what your mind is doing during the exercise and so on. So he would certainly drop in, and there were retreats once in a while where he would be in attendance and give critique and feedback and possibly introduce a new exercise.
And where did these exercises come from that he was teaching?
That's a really interesting question that nobody's ever really honestly been able to say definitively. From what we can gather, they are either from his training in Tibet, from the monastic dance tradition, that one of which dances was the I don't know what you call it, the Chakrasamvara dance was a dance that was done at the New Year at Losar by his monastery. And as the abbot of the monastery, he was expected to lead the dance. So he was trained in this dance, which goes on for 24 hours nonstop, which is, you know, done with very heavy brocade costumes and bell and drum, and there are musicians and there's visualizations and there's chanting and there are 64 dancers and so on and so forth. So it's a very rigorous training. Now, whether or not these exercises were the training or were his adaptations for wimpy Westerners of his training, we don't know. He never really got into that.
I've seen videos of these dance performances or ceremonies.
Yes.
And what I hadn't thought about before is that, because he developed the Maitri space awareness in the rooms of different color. And then so it was like very psychological experience. And this is more of the movement aspect of what he taught in the West.
Yes, it definitely adds a lot more movement. But I would say if you wanted to contrast, because the Maitri, I mean, the Buddha families are certainly part of space awareness.
Right.
So it's not like it's a separate thing. And in fact, at that conference, he gave one talk that was specifically about those energies. But I would say that the space awareness that we're talking about in the mudra work was more like learning about the form and space interplay of things. And then the Maitri work, or not the Maitri work, the Buddha family work, invites the kind of colorfulnesses onto the canvas of form and space.
Okay. I hadn't thought about it in this way before. So this is helpful to me, just to sort of round out the practices that he was bringing to the West.
Yeah. They're both these are definitely from the Vajrayana, Tibetan Vajrayana tradition. And the Chakrasamvara dance is definitely a sadhana to the Yidam Chakrasamvara, who's the main Yidam of his monastery.
So when you came, I'm just going back to your story, picking up that thread.
Okay.
So after the second year, you come up and you are doing some teaching and you're connecting with the mudra space awareness people. How did your involvement with space awareness develop from there?
Well, there were many years of practice and teaching, and this was one of the practices that the mudra group, we had permission. Well, let's go back. At that time, people who were studying with Trungpa were expected to do, I think, 9 hours of meditation practice a month in a group, 3-hour slots on the weekends. And we were given permission, if we were practicing mudra, that we didn't have to do the 3-hour sitting meditation block.
Okay.
So that was quite nice, although for some people it was more torturous to do mudra than it was to sit quietly for 3 hours. But in terms of the first time I actually saw the mudra group perform was the second summer when I came up to teach, and they were performing the play that they had been rehearsing, I suppose, quite a long time during the year, Prajna. And I didn't think that the play was very good, and I thought that the acting was terrible. But the first thing that happened was that the cast in a monastic kind of costume and so on walks into the playing space. And I was absolutely stunned at the kind of majesty of their presence. And that really, I saw that there was really something different about the way they were. Like the play, now maybe I could understand it sort of, maybe, but Trungpa Rinpoche was never trying to make theater for the masses. He was teaching the Dharma. And he was especially teaching the Dharma to his students, both the mudra students and the other students. So to make a play that's based on the Heart Sutra makes a lot of sense in that context. So
my sense is that when you saw this production of them coming in their monastic robes, that you used the expression earlier that he was trying to convey of authentic presence, you kind of got that hit of what this
was. It was completely clear. Yeah.
And my sense would be that sort of made you curious to get further involved in this.
Oh, I was already completely curious. No, I was curious from the moment I started experiencing what he was talking about in that theater conference. because it was so resonant with my sense of what was missing. And also because during that first summer when I was teaching improvisational theater and learning how to meditate and hearing about basic Buddhist principles, it was so precious to have a vocabulary for what I was trying to teach my young actors, you know, to actually have a language that was speaking to what I sort of knew because of my training in performance. So you could sort of say I became a Buddhist because it was good for theater, rather than I became a Buddhist because it was good for religious purposes or something else. I don't know what.
I love that because I had never heard that before.
So that, yeah, well, that. There are not too many of us out there, I guess.
who come to the Buddha Dharma through theater. And
yeah, well, I mean, of all of those people who came from those theater companies, I don't know of any of them else who really picked up the space awareness work and made it part of their method, training, acting training method.
So at what point did you start to deepen your training in the space awareness and then begin to teach it?
I'm not sure what the year was. Probably it was 10 or 12 years after starting to learn the practice.
Okay.
I mean,
so in the mid 80s or something like
that. Yes, I think it was very much whatever the year was when some kind of spaceship exploded somewhere. I remember because I was teaching a class and we decided that we couldn't do anything about the spaceship, but we could carry on with the work.
Okay.
But it took me a long time. I really, and when I'm training teachers, I maintain that until you don't apologize, then you feel no apology for telling people to do these things that on the surface of it seem so, you know, hard or torturous or painful or whatever you want to label things, until you know in your soul almost how valuable this work is, you're not ready to teach it.
What would you say that value is? I've done, you know, a couple of programs, you know, doing the space awareness, and for me, it there is sort of a torturous quality to it.
It's your mind.
There you go. I mean, exactly.
Well, it's always hard to look at one's mind.
It brings up torturous quality of mind.
It does indeed, yes.
And you found that to be true for yourself also?
Well, less than most people, because I sort of wanted to clean my mind out of all those storylines. I mean, I'm an actress after all, and I never doubted that if you're going to act, you have to get rid of a lot of your own shit. Otherwise, as Trumper would say, you're not only doing the neurosis of the character you're playing, but you're doing your own neurosis on top of that. So you're doubly neurotic. What good is that?
Right.
So, yeah. So I think I probably had an easier time than many people who had a lot more to hold on to.
Maybe that's me.
But I definitely think that if anyone is interested in working to become more of an energy than a ego, this work is invaluable, absolutely invaluable. First of all, because like many things in Buddhism, it teaches by taking your assumptions about the way things are and asking you to push them all the way to the point where there's no longer any doubt in your mind that you were wrong. Well, nobody likes to be wrong, but on the other hand, you know, to be, actually see through the idea that you're a separate, individual, contained thing, is to see that that's a mistake. And right. not just to see it as an intellectual idea, as you do if you study the texts and so on, but to actually see it because you can't escape.
Right.
And that's important.
There's a very physiological aspect to the practice.
Oh, it's very, yes. Using the physical to educate the mind.
Right, right.
But also using the mind to educate the body too. Mm. So it works both ways. And using space as the kind of holding it together. I think we in the West anyway, don't pay nearly enough attention to space as the element we swim in.
Right.
You know, we just take it for granted,
right?
Which has obviously been quite a mistake.
And there isn't, most of us don't have an experience of the space penetrating us. There's this permeability aspect to our body.
Well, our body is space.
Our body is space.
Right. We don't think of it that way.
And we intend not to experience it in that way.
Yes. Right. Yeah, it's very much a clunky kind of chunky thing.
Oh yeah.
But if you're a performer, you can't. It's awkward enough having one, but if you're on top of having one, stuck in a particular pattern, it doesn't get you very far.
And this is just in terms of, you're just talking in terms of theater here.
I'm not talking anymore just in terms of theater, but certainly that was my background and my entry point. And I definitely, when I teach, I use a lot of theatrical images as tools because it brings it to a kind of like daily life point of view rather than a sort of spiritual point of view. Mm-hmm. People can respond to the daily life problem of being stuck in their habitual ruts, you know. So it makes sense.
So I'm going back through the timeline here. And so in mid-80s, you begin to teach the space awareness.
Right.
And how many people were at this point, mid-80s, teaching space awareness in the it's mainly Vajradhatu Sangha in the Ropa.
We were a company. I mean, we were a group, and we all led the group from time to time.
Okay.
So I don't know, 15 or so.
Okay.
Maximum. Yeah, they came and went, you know, people about that time was also about the time that other venues for doing things within the mandala was happening. So people became Kasong and Kusong and people, you know, had businesses and so on, many of whom got their training with us in the theater group and then went on to do other things with it.
So when did you become a member of Naropa?
1974,
summer of 74, and then it becomes Naropa Institute, and then it becomes an academic institution.
Yeah, it was a summer institute for 1974 summer and 1975 summer. Then in the winter of 1976, it became a sort of year-round school. And I moved up to start the theater program. And, you know, we were kind of not, we were not an academic institute at that point. We were Naropa Institute, a kind of a scratchy sort of a bunch of people learning to meditate and teaching their profession or their art form or whatever. at that time. And then I don't know the exact date, but somewhere down the line, then it was felt that it would be good to get an accreditation for one thing, because the students couldn't get the grants and so on unless there was an accreditation involved. So we went through that process in the 80s sometime. And then we acquired the Lincoln School, which was our first sort of actual home, you know, rooms for classes and things.
So you were heading up the theater department. So as Naropa Institute became a full one-year program, you were the director of the theater department at that point?
Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't exactly like I was the director. It was, I was the teacher of theater.
Okay. And but, and part of the teaching was the mudra space awareness.
No. Not for a long time. No. I was just a student of space awareness at that time. But I did, after a while, when we had to become accredited, we also had to make up curricular programs, you know, rather than just teaching from whatever. And that was an interesting time of, you know, what do you do in the first semester? What do you do in the second semester? What is the training? And so little by little, the results that I was receiving from space awareness kind of got snuck into the way I was teaching. And then in the latter part of the 80s, I decided that there was no real reason any longer why I couldn't have one of the semesters of my teaching curriculum be a semester of space awareness. So at that point we were a 2-year college. We only taught junior and senior college.
Third
and fourth years, right. We only taught that. So it was four sessions. And the mudra came in as the third session.
Okay. Now, was there, in that program, was there retreats that you would do with the students around space awareness?
No. It was just an academic program.
Okay.
There were still retreats that the mudra people would do. Yeah.
And where would you go on these retreats?
Well, either it would be a retreat just working in town, or it would be at the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center.
Okay.
A couple of them, good ones, good long ones up at the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center.
Mm.
You know, in the summers, or at least it was warm, I seem to recall, you know, being working in a tent with the sides up. So
So after you connected with Punlap Rinpoche and began to study with him, how did space awareness fit in with Nalanda Bodhi Boulder, right? Nalanda Bodhi Sangha?
Well, I'm not sure it's ever fitted in.
Okay.
I mean, how it came to even be in the eyes of Punlap Rinpoche was I invited him to come to a class. He was a teacher at Naropa, as was I, and I was teaching a space awareness class. And I invited him to come and take a look and have the students ask him questions. And so he did come and looked. It was lovely to have him there. And he gave us some lovely teachings around space. And then since that time, he has always been a champion of the work and feels that it would be very valuable for his students. It's very difficult, however, because it's a practice, and it's not a practice you can do on your own like shamatha. You have a need for a group. And at least so far, I personally think you have a need for actual bodies in the same space with one another. So the current situation we're in makes that difficult. I know that there's another teacher or a couple teachers who are doing it over the Zoom and so on. you know, I mean, the Maitri is done with the colored glasses too. So, you know, there are those kind of things, but I happen to be a purist. And I think, you know, you need your body. I don't see any reason why we want to short circuit the fact that we've got this intelligent organism that knows so many things that the mind is groping towards, but yet doesn't understand. Anyway, that's beside the point.
No, I appreciate hearing that. Yeah. So what is the, in your opinion, the minimum number of people that need to be together to be able to do the practice?
Well, to have a group, what would you say? I mean, could you just call a group three?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe five. Everything never said it has to be X number, but you've got to have somebody who is guiding the exercises. You've got to have at least a couple of people doing the exercises. If you've only got that, you don't have much mental energy going on. The more people you have, at least up to a certain point, I haven't really taught more than about 150 at a time, so I can't really go beyond that. But the more people you have, the more intelligence you have, the more wisdom can be generated from the energy that's being put in that direction. Just like when you sit shamatha with a group of people, even if your practice is maybe a little shaky, there's always someone's practice there that can help support and strengthen your own, or you can strengthen someone else's. It's just the way the mind works.
That's my experience.
Yeah. So same with this stuff. You learn much more the more people are learning together. So I would say, for me, comfortably as a teacher or a group leader, I like maybe a group of 12 or so, but I've taught four or five people. I've gone, you know, been brought places where they weren't able to gather a group, and yet you have to go on, you know. But it's really not a teaching situation so much as it is an exercise situation. Once you know the exercises, then it's a question of practicing them.
And how many exercises are there?
Oh, maybe 14 or so.
Okay.
This includes physical exercises, sense perception exercises, vocal exercises, body, speech, and mind.
Okay. And I'm intrigued by you. You mentioned that there's a shamatha aspect to this, and there's a vipassana aspect to the space awareness practices. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's according to Trungpa Rinpoche.
Okay. And so my guess would be that this 14 practices have a kind of an opening quality, that once you kind of sort of stabilize to a certain extent, basic 14, and then things open up.
Well.
Or...
maybe basic three.
Basic three.
They're put into sets. And the first set, I would say, is definitely the shamatha set. Now, shamatha in this case doesn't mean stable in the sense of quiet and still necessarily. But I think you're right. It is kind of like the stabilizing of mind. Then the vipassana exercises come along when things start to move. So the next set, there's movement happening, entering into space in like walking and coming from sitting down to standing up and so on. And then there are around those two sets, a lot of peripheral exercises that maybe they're a shamatha vipassana blend, or maybe at that point, you let go of the strict rigidity of the shamatha vipassana, and you're just exploring, you know, your instruments, so to speak. Like the voice work, I don't know where it would fit in a shamatha vipassana structure, but it's definitely based in the stability and understandings gained from how intensification and relaxation work together.
And then out of that, from what you're describing, there's sort of an exploring of space out of that.
Yes. Yeah, space, but also exploring of body.
Right. Right. So
that is space too, of course. But, you know, how those two support each other. I mean, I think one of the things that I've really learned from this work is how precious it is to be able to co-create with space.
Like how so? How? Well,
you know, I think as humans, generally Western humans, think that it's something you have to do. You have to think. You have to have an idea. You have, if there's a committee meeting, you have to come up with a plan. And to learn that actually the plan is not, you're not going to come up with it, but if you open to it, it will reveal itself. It's a different way of looking, and a lot more pleasant oftentimes, because it's so surprising when you let go of it having to be your plan, because you and you let it just arise from a co-creation.
Well, it makes me think of, you know, the statements about Buddha activity, that it just spontaneously happens without a lot of pre-planning and pre-thought, is what you're describing here.
I never thought of it that way. That sounds so lofty, but yeah, I guess so. Some of my favorite times have been, there's a wonderful old farmhouse in Poland where we have gathered from time to time, and we cook and eat and clean and sit and practice and perform and sing and, you know, together. And at those times, it is truly like that. Things just sort of unfold. And sometimes with as many as 9 languages going on, because actually language is not communication, it's just words. And once you get into the mind, you don't need all that extra stuff. And I think learning that has been really important for my European groups. I really feel that I've done good service with that, to help people beyond their language boundaries to a flow with, you know, what it is to be. That's all.
Makes me want to go to Poland with you.
Me, I want to go back.
I can imagine.
So long. Oh, yeah. Well, it's a special, very special place.
Now, how often have you gone there?
Oh, I think I only went there about 4 times.
Okay. It sounds very magical.
Oh, it was. And we could do it. Well, yeah, we could do it in this, you know, if there were a place, but you have to have a place, and that's so hard to find. We do it also at Ditch and Chilling now, but it's not quite the same, because Ditch and Chilling has a staff and they cook for us, and, you know, we're the guests. So it's different, but it's still very enjoyable to be together and practice. And we do both space awarenesses in combination.
My experience is that when I'm in a group, sort of like group retreat, that when we cook together, it adds an extra something to it. Rather than being attended to. And it just, totally. You know, because you really get to know people when you, quote unquote, are working with them. And when you're working on a meal and, you know, creating a meal together, you get to, you can get a little gritty sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. Well, that's that kind of thing, that those making those opportunities to get a little gritty in many different ways, I think, are really what's necessary for people to find new ways of trusting each other.
Yeah. So you're retired now from Europa.
Yeah.
And how is it to be retired?
From Europa?
From Europa, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, Naropa is going through its own transformations, and I don't know how the new ones are, what, where they're headed. I try to keep myself from too much in curiosity. And I miss teaching. I really miss having a class. I miss seeing people grow and make discoveries over time. The what I can do now is little weekends, or used to be able to do before everything got locked down. But weekends or short things are not nearly as satisfying as to have a 15-week group that's coming together on a regular basis. So I miss that, but I don't miss being a college professor. I never was much of a college professor. My parents were college professors, and was definitely not something on my list of what I wanted to be when I grew up. And Naropa wasn't a college, even once it was accredited, for quite a long time. So it was all right, you know. But the older it gets, the more it gets to be a college. And the more you need to have a PhD in order to teach there, the more what you've studied is PhD-ness and what it is to be an academic rather than what it is to be a practitioner or even a meditator. You know, so I don't miss that part at all.
But the getting to work with students and share what you have to share, because my experience of you is you're very experienced in your teaching. Very experiential. So I can imagine the students really enjoying your classes and getting a lot out of them.
I surely hope so.
I can well imagine.
It again. I wish I could do it again. But getting back to that question about how it's Nalanda Bodhi's or Punlop Rinpoche and space awareness related, you know, we have tried to a certain extent. And I would say the most success that we've had is that at Nitartha, where there are 9-day blocks, and people very often come for a 2-block summer session, which is 18 days. And that's good because I can meet with people every day. And it helps. It's been especially helpful to my mind anyway, in terms of East and Western students working together, because so many of the Asian students, English is a shy, they're good at English, but shy at joining in an English thing. And of course the Westerners are not Chinese speakers for the most part. So having a physical kind of place to study the Dharma together, I think has been really a good asset to the school. I'm hoping that the school thinks so too. And I can't wait to see if we can get back together in real time again, because that's been pretty successful. Doing things, little tastes here and there is maybe a nice, you know, taste or curiosity thing, but I haven't been able to find a way to make actually something more substantial happen.
Let's put out a wish here. If there's anyone who's listening to this or watching this who has a inspiration on how to make this aspiration of Mitra Lee's come true.
Oh, bless your heart. Let's just aspire to be in the same space.
And to look at what you have to offer and seeing if there's more opportunities for that.
Well, the other thing that I feel is important to think about is that one of the things about a practice that is as difficult to figure out as this one, in terms of needing a group, in terms of you're always a beginner at it. It's not that you're going to achieve it. You're just going to learn more the more you do it, kind of thing. And that people, it's best if people from many different ways of thinking come together and all of those things. The good thing is it's kept it pretty pure over these years, both in terms of the teachers, pretty much understand that it's not something to add to the things on their charm bracelet, you know, a little of this and a little of that, that it is in itself a practice that has a cohesiveness to it. And also in terms of the loyalty of the students, we can see each other after 5 or 6 years and pick up as though we had been together yesterday, because the depth of connection that has come through working together in these kind of groups is very, very strong. So those are good things.
Yeah. And how many people are teaching the space awareness?
Well, it comes and goes. Maybe 10 or 12.
Okay. Are there any new students who are being trained by the original group to carry on the teaching of this practice?
The original group is no longer.
Okay.
2 or 3 of us from Boulder, and 2 or 3 others from other places where Rinpoche taught, like the people at Karma Choling right now. We're from a group, we're taught in San Francisco area, and they have a very interesting, different sort of approach to space awareness that I think it was kind of earlier, maybe by the time it got to the Boulder group, I think Rinpoche had worked out some of the confusions, but that group, yeah, they're teaching at Karma Choling now by Zoom, I think.
Okay.
But most of the people that I work with that are teaching, were teaching, are from Europe. Okay. And I have maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 or so people from Naropa that have continued on.
Okay.
Maybe not as teachers, but maybe as assistant teachers, most of them.
Okay.
One who is, she's a wonderful teacher. She was also a teacher at Naropa, but she's not teaching there anymore.
Okay. Is there a next generation of teachers who will carry on this practice? Do you know?
Who can predict the future?
Okay. Okay.
Is there a future?
Yeah. Well,
one thing I've often thought about is that I've asked myself, if Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche were to come to the West now, would he be even presenting this material? Because, you know, at the time when it was presented, one of the things about it was that it was a way to teach the Dharma that didn't have Dharma language. But now, as you know, I mean, the Shedra approach is perfectly fine. So people can study the original texts and so on. And there's lots of Buddhism out there. But when Rinpoche was teaching, he was teaching people who had never considered meditating or looking at their mind. I don't even know if they thought they had a mind or if they distinguished mind from thoughts ever. You know, so would he do this now? I don't know, but I suspect that things that have truth to them find the way of presenting themselves that's appropriate for the time in which they're being presented, and they're clinging to something that really worked at a certain point is not maybe the best way to think of how the Dharma enters a culture.
Okay.
I'm not saying that it's not going to go on, but I'm not as concerned as some people that if it morphs into something else, that's all right.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about around space awareness that we haven't touched upon?
Well, let me look at my notes.
Okay.
I just see.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Yes, there are a couple of things.
Oh, well, please.
If you've got the time.
I've got the time. I'm not going anywhere.
All right. Yeah, well, one of them is maybe I could just say something about the word mudra. Okay. Because I think it's been kind of a word that has attracted people, and people think of mudras as things that you do with your hands, like you know, the earth touching mudra of Buddha, or there's a Christian symbolism mudra. I don't know what it signifies, but Jesus does it sometimes. And, you know, I mean, there are those kind of mudras. There's also traditions of Indian culture dance with hand mudras that tell stories and dance form. But in this case, mudra, which means gesture or sign or symbol, is used in the sentence, "You are your own mudra."
Hmm.
Or you could say, "You are the sign or the symbol of yourself."
Hmm.
And that works very nicely if you're teaching performers, because we oftentimes performers have this kind of, I guess, wish that they could be somebody else. But unfortunately, that's part of your mudra, mm-hmm. that wish that you could be somebody else, you know, and getting clear about that is really helpful in terms of beginning to either see how little confidence you have in your own mudra, or claiming your own mudra in a more strong and centered, confident way. Mm-hmm. So that's that one. And the other thing I think that has come through so importantly to me from the years that I've spent with this practice is something that I wrote down on my list of things I might want to say this way: the universe is a friendly place.
Mm.
And these days, it's so easy to slip into a kind of sense that the universe is against us, or me. The universe is against me. It's being done to me. But actually, you can't really practice space awareness without realizing the benevolence and generosity and accommodation, kindness and support. You couldn't be here without space.
Mm.
The universe is a friendly place.
Mm.
And if you can learn to allow yourself to work with it, rather than thinking that you have to fight it or stand against it or do it all by yourself, then life becomes a lot more graceful and a lot gentler.
Mm.
And your mudra shines. Better.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that. The benevolent quality. Benevolent quality. Yeah. Because a lot of people don't have that sense at all.
Where would they learn it these days?
Yeah. Yeah.
You mean it takes stopping, for one thing. It takes stopping. It takes being able to be bored.
And the way that our culture is going with all of iPads, iPhones, that you never have to be alone.
Yeah.
And have silence.
Right.
I remember one of the sayings or teachings of Trungpa Rinpoche, where he said something like, "We're always looking for a mate. We get in the car, we immediately turn on the radio. we come home and we turn on the television. There's always this wanting something. So we aren't alone."
Yeah, that's a good one. And I also like Lama Tempa's, "We're not human beings, we're human doings."
Exactly. 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 Well, thank you. Thank you for spending this time with me. And I just have a lot of appreciation for who you are and your teaching.
So, well,
may you continue for a long time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being asked these questions. Thank you,
thank
Doug.
Thank you. Okay. And bye.